Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program today. My guest is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him. Call those in to 765-496-1999. Email us, ask@wbaa.org is our address. And you can go to WBAA News on Twitter and send in your questions there. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I wanted to start by talking about the blast of winter weather we're getting again this week. It caused me to start asking you mayors about how your roads have been faring. I saw where your county commissioners there recently got an earful from some residents about the condition of county roads. How are the city's roads doing?
We're actually doing fairly well this year. I think, you know, with these cycles, we've had the opportunity to get out there as we've had some, you know, milder temperatures to get out there and do some patchwork. So we've been able to kind of stay ahead of it, and it's not been as bad as it has been in some years. Now, keeping in mind that, you know, we could have an extended cold blast here that puts us behind again. But right now, we seem to be doing fairly well.
So in terms of salt supply and things like that, we've had a little bit more precipitation this year than we've had the past couple. Did you have enough stashed away from previous years that you're not really eating into that too much beyond what you expected, or do you think you'll have to buy a little extra?
No, we're right on track there. I think we planned fairly well, and we have plenty of salt, and I think we have a unique advantage there in that there's a major salt distribution facility located right here within the city of Crawfordsville. So, you know, communities all over the state are coming here to get their salt, and if we were to run into a problem, there's literally mountains of salt here that we could access. So salt is definitely not an issue for us.
Just break down the doors if you need to.
I suppose we could find our way in somehow.
We got a question from a listener, Brian, about this week's Indiana Senate bias crime bill vote. And with the exception of the bill's author, Lafayette Senator Ron Alting, who voted with all of the Democrats who were present against his own bill, the bill passed largely along party lines. Republicans have supported a stripped-down bill, which does not include a list of victim characteristics, and that has drawn rebukes even from Governor Eric Holcomb. So Brian's message to you is this, and I'm going to read it now exactly as he has written it. He says, and I'm quoting now, "Without mishmash equivocating, please tell us in straightforward language how you plan to confront Phil Boots and take him to task for his, what Brian calls, hateful Senate Bill 12 amendment vote." And Brian says, "If I hear even one in your reply to my question, I'm turning the radio off."
Well, you know, I don't know. That's a complicated issue, and I followed it some on the periphery, and you know, I will have to say that I am in the camp with the governor on this, and I cannot understand, you know, why Indiana can't really figure this out. I don't know, it baffles me. As far as my direct conversation with Senator Boots on this issue, we have not discussed this issue to this point, and I'm sure we will at some point. You know, it's just the opportunity has not presented itself yet. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'll ask him about it, and certainly he'll have his explanation, and that'll be that. I don't think, and I've said this many, many times on this show, I don't think the folks in the legislature are largely paying attention to what's happening in local government. I don't think they put much credence into that. I've spent some time at the legislature this year, and they're kind of in their own world. So what I say or don't say, I really don't think makes much difference, sadly.
This is one of those issues that it seems to me has drawn some lines within the Republican Party, and you can see it as urban versus rural. There are some lines within the business community. You point out the difference between what happens at the local level where your city Human Rights Commission has tried to make sure that your ordinances are reflective of language that does not discriminate specifically on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. And then you've got, even at the State House, the one part of the State House to the other. The governor says one thing, the legislature seems to want to do the other thing. What do you do to solve that schism within a lot of the Republican levers of government that control a lot of Indiana? Is there a way to solve it?
Well, communication is always the key, you know, and I did hear Governor Holcomb say in, you know, in an interview last night that, look, you know, all Republicans don't think alike. We're not a bunch of robots, nor do all Democrats think alike. You're going to have some dissension there. People are complicated today, And I always say people don't fit nicely into those little categories that we like to place them in and say this person fits in this category and every belief they have, you know, aligns exactly with this category or this label. So, you know, I think that becomes more and more challenging today because people have exposure, they have access to greater amounts of information, and they're going to form more complex views and opinions, if you will. So, you know, within the party, there just needs to be discussion on this and find some of that common ground, some of that, that compromise, middle of the road area, if you will, to move things forward. But we cannot, and I emphasize this over and over, if at any point people within the Republican Party think we can put our heads in the sand and be the party that we were 50 years ago, they're wrong. The world is changing so rapidly around us. And I'm not saying we have to erode our ideals, but what I am saying is that you really need to pay attention to this global economy and the things that are happening in this world.
Something else that happened legislatively recently that potentially affects your city, Democrats try to add an amendment to the state budget bill that would have reestablished funding for the Hoosier State Line, which Governor Holcomb had previously announced he wanted taken out, and it looks like the House Ways and Means Committee has complied. So it now seems very unlikely that the state is going to continue to supply that funding, which would mean that train service is likely to be only a few days a week through Crawfordsville and Lafayette and Rensselaer. What is your next step if that becomes the permanent way of being?
Well, I did have the opportunity, you know, we've had some discussion amongst the mayors and the commissioners on this issue, and I had the opportunity to sit down and discuss this with Governor Holcomb last week. And, you know, his position is very firm on this, and I appreciate that he's upfront about it, and I wish we would have known about this ahead of time. But, you know, his position is that unless we can present a plan that really presents a realistic opportunity for this being self-sufficient, then he's not going to continue to fund it. And the reality is that none of us in local government have the ability to do that. We simply can't do it because we're at the mercy of too many other forces. For example, the host railroads. You literally cannot improve on-time performance unless they cooperate. And to date, none of them have been willing to really cooperate much. So our hands are pretty tight on this issue. You know, I know the state's looking at some other things. You know, they're more interested in direct foreign flights out of Indianapolis than they are this kind of issue. And my take on this is that, you know, we'll adapt and we'll continue to work. Very sadly, I'm not sure that my generation or the generation above me is going to fix this. I just don't think the capability is there, the understanding is there to fix this, and it's probably going to get pushed off to a younger generation that values mass transit to fix this, because it just literally cannot wrap their heads around this concept. To them, you know, everyone should own a car, and they're thinking like we thought years ago, and let's pour some more money, you know, for Pete's sake, into I-65. I mean, I-65 is a disaster, and they just keep pouring more money into that. So until we can change that mindset, I just don't see this changing.
Would you ever consider trying to lure another private operator to do similar to what Iowa Pacific did for a year or 18 months there, which was essentially augment on the off days the service between Indianapolis and Chicago?
Well, I think that's an interesting concept, and I think, you know, if you could control those host railroads and you could control all those other issues, that would be great. But there are so many factors stacked against that working, you know. In Iowa Pacific's case, the deck was stacked against them from day one, you know. And you just can't change those factors. And there's plenty of blame to go around here. I mean, it's easy to point fingers and say, well, you know, the governor has eliminated this funding, but there is plenty of blame to go around. And until we can fix this system that allows these things to continue on the path that they're on, we're not going to get anywhere. And make no mistake, there are lobbying forces against what we were doing. You know, the highway lobby, the construction lobby, they want all this money poured into roads. You know, and we just have to, I think we're kind of stuck here. I don't see this changing for a while.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Please call in your questions. Area code 765-496-1999. Email ask@wbaa.org or tweet at WBAA News on Twitter. Your city is set to get its third solar park construction starting this spring. When that is done, do you have any sense of how many homes might be able to be powered by all of the solar capacity that you'll have?
Well, actually, you know, breaking news, we're set to get our third, but we are also in talks right now to add our fourth, and I believe we'll see a request for some abatement go before the city council committee next Monday night for the fourth solar park. So we're moving pretty quickly in that arena. After the third is constructed, we will be up to 15 megawatts capacity on solar. That's pretty significant. You know, if you look at the total load of Crawfordsville, I mean, it's maybe, you know, and I might get in trouble here. Don't work in that realm every day, but I think it's probably easily over a third of our total load, maybe even closer to half, when it's producing at its peak, which, you know, it's not enough to get you by, but it is significant. And through IMPA, we're producing the solar power at a very, very cost-effective rate. The key here and what sets this apart is that we use that power locally, and it offsets what we pull from the grid. So, you know, once you put the power on the grid, the transport fees and all those kinds of other fees, you know, tend to really drive up the cost and make it cost prohibitive. But if you can use it locally and offset what you're pulling, it makes tremendous sense, and that's what we're doing here.
We're working on some reporting as well about the continuing discussions about wind farms there in Montgomery County. And it's interesting because there are similar conversations going on here in Tippecanoe County. And we're also talking to the people who have embraced this in Benton County. And it's kind of interesting because the discussion's a little bit different every single place. And with respect to renewable energy, it seems like the city of Crawfordsville is trying to do something, and then the county is kind of taking a slightly different view of renewable. Would you say that's accurate?
No, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't think that the county is against renewable energy. I think when you compare the solar and you compare the wind power, it really is apples and oranges, and it's a totally different scenario. You know, the solar is, for lack of a better phrase, non-invasive. You know, it doesn't disturb the neighbors in any way, and you really don't even know it's there. It is cost efficient right now if you do it correctly. Wind, you know, is big and, according to some people, ugly and noisy, and, you know, you do see it, and it does affect your neighbors, and it's currently, minus the subsidies, is not cost effective. So those are kind of apples and oranges, and I don't think the county by any means is you know, anti renewable energy. In fact, they are a partner in some of these solar agreements. Some of the land in which the second park will be built on, actually where the first park is built, was owned by the county. So the county has sold at a very, you know, reasonable price to IMPA to construct two of these parks. They also, I believe, are in the process of considering a tax abatement for an additional solar park for the town of Darlington, which, you know, this park will be located in unincorporated areas. So the county's been very supportive of that. I think the wind and the solar are just two different issues.
Well, you mentioned the idea of subsidies, and then you've also mentioned tax abatements in a couple of different ways. Tax abatements are, in essence, subsidizing solar, too, are they not?
Well, yeah, they are. But, I mean, when I'm talking subsidies, I'm talking the direct federal subsidy to offset the production of the energy, which is it's a little bit different than saying, you know, if you bring this solar park to our community, we're gonna phase in your taxes, and that's one reason we have more capacity coming to Crawfordsville, as IMPA looks to grow their solar portfolio, their solar production. They look around the state, and some communities are easy to do business in, and others are not. And we've proven that we are a community that's, you know, it's easy to do business here. They understand the lay of the land. We move through the process, and for me, it's a win all the way around, because, you know, we're going to abate those taxes, we're going to phase those in. But if you look at the lifespan of those solar panels and how much we will actually collect in taxes over that time, versus what we're collecting now with many times vacant ground that's just sitting there, it's a no-brainer. So I think it's a win.
One of the things we keep getting told as we're talking to people, whether it's county commissioners or people who are with the wind industry, is that they can't talk about this because either they don't want to do anything to the deal or they don't know anything. Or there's some people who even say they wonder if gag orders have been signed as this discussion has gone along, as they decide whether there are even going to be any wind turbines put in Montgomery County. Is that anything you've heard about? Have you heard about people signing deals saying that they are not allowed to talk about this because and there are others who say that hey, look, we're still working on the comprehensive plan for the county and we don't know how wind figures into that. Where is there truth in any of that as far as you can tell?
Well, I mean, as far as the government officials go, I mean, I'm certain they've not signed any kind of gag order or anything like that. But, you know, as far as the relationship that a private landowner has with a, you know, a company that wants to lease their land, I don't know what they've signed, and I don't know if they've sign something saying that they won't discuss terms or anything like that. I can't answer that. But my read on this right now, and I've, as I said a few months ago, I've inserted myself in this a little bit just to kind of help facilitate the conversation, because even though it's an issue that doesn't directly affect the city, it started to affect the city because it was becoming so big and engulfing our community and really splitting us into groups and factions, and we don't need that. So I've been involved enough to help facilitate the conversation, and my read right now is that this is going to get resolved in the next few months. You know, there will be winners and losers. There will be people who like the way it's resolved, and there will be people who do not. But I give the commissioners credit. I think they're listening to the community, and they're trying to gather all the facts and make a really informed decision the best they can within their legal powers, and you know, this is a county without planning and zoning, so that looks entirely different than it does in Tippecanoe County or another county.
What's your gut feeling when this all comes through? Turbines or no turbines?
At this point, I would say no turbines.
Okay. You talked about splitting the county and making it factionalized. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because the other thing we're finding is that there are some fairly scientifically unverifiable things being said by opponents of wind farms. And if the debate veers in that direction, does it hurt the image of the county if you've got a bunch of things being put out there that are, to use the popular vernacular, fake news?
I think that's been an issue, you know, really throughout this process. And certainly that's, you know, a message that I carried, you know, to the anti-wind group, is that, you know, if you want to engage this conversation and you're opposed to these, you know, I think everybody understands the core basic reasons. I would just stay out of the things that are questionable science and all that. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, I don't want this next to my house because it's ugly. I don't like it. You know, it's okay, whatever. But to say, you know, is putting off all these different kinds of waves and stuff, I mean, there you get into science that can be debated, and there's a lot of room for interpretation, all that. So we've seen that. You've seen that on both sides, you know, really. And you just have to be careful. I see the news stories that get shared on social media, and then you kind of have to unwind it and look back and look at the source. And then there's a lot of liberty taken in those stories. So it is an issue, and I don't think, you know, again, to the commissioner's credit, they're not going to make an ill-informed decision based on fake news or fake facts, if you will.
We talked about the Hoosier State Line train a little bit ago, and I wanted to mention something else that has to do a little bit with trains in your community. We've talked a number of times with you on the show about the problems you have had with the railroads whose tracks go through, and with them stopping sometimes long trains for great periods of time that backs up traffic. I understand you've installed some new infrastructure to help traffic flow better if there are backups. Is that right?
We did change the signaling system at the intersection of Wabash Avenue and Mill Street, and that is the location of the one rail overpass within our city. So the one spot that everybody has to go to, you know, in the event of these blockages, that is the choke point. That is the place that everybody has to get to get from one side of the city to the other. So the traffic signal there was an older system, was very dated. as we've had some of these blockages and we go back and evaluate what happened, you know, on our end, how did we deal with this, you know, from a traffic flow standpoint or public safety standpoint, it always kind of came back to problems at that particular intersection. You have an intersection on the bridge, so it's kind of a complicated scenario, but it was definitely the choke point. It was definitely our where our backups started to happen. We couldn't move traffic through there quickly enough. So, you know, we really, recommendations that came out was to reprogram that signal to adapt, and we could not physically do that. So we made the decision to go ahead and spend the money to put in a new signaling system, one that monitors traffic flow, has the sensors in the road, and can adjust automatically. We don't have to, you know, send somebody down there to change it because there's a train. It should sense that heavy traffic and start to adjust those flows to move traffic through. So it's been in place for just a little bit now. We've not had, knock on wood, a blockage since then. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll get lucky. But it'll be interesting to see when that does occur, how this improves things, because I think it will drastically improve traffic flow.
On to another transportation topic of sorts. Your city's League of Women Voters is getting set to hold a forum at the Crawfordsville Airport, which is an amenity that you have talked about needing to bolster and trying to make more money on. Is usage of the airport something you can grow from within? Do you think that there are enough people there who could find some way to use that space that you don't have to have that investment, that money coming from outside the community?
I don't know that you're going to get, you know, to the point within the community itself, you know, to make this self-sufficient. I don't really know that that's the case, and I don't really know that that's the goal. You know, when I look at who uses our airport, it's about local business and industry, and then it's about the people who have planes who fly. But even when I look at that you know, demographic or that list, if you will, the majority of those people are not Crawfordsville residents. They you know, put their plane here for various reasons. So we're not really necessarily targeting the community itself. What we are targeting is that business community. You know, businesses here have customers, they have suppliers, they have all these, you know, groups that they touch on that come and go. And sometimes it makes a lot of sense for them to be able to access our community directly rather than flying in somewhere else, renting a car, and so on. And, you know, every indication is if you look at the benchmarks, and the number one benchmark being the sale of fuel at an airport, we're doing very well. Our fuel sales are up, you know, like seven times what they were the year before. So we're headed in the right direction. We have some more things to figure out. I think last year was probably our roughest year because we were making so many changes and people are resistant to change. So we heard a lot about that. But now that we're kind of over the hump, if you will, I think we'll see things get much better.
Do you see many cargo flights come in and out of the airport to supply the businesses in the community?
We don't really see cargo. We see, you know, management staff. We see people flying in to conduct business and then flying back out. We see that quite a bit. You know, we have, you know, commercial aircraft, you know, corporate aircraft, if you will, in not every day, but pretty close to it. And it is, that is indicated by the sale of fuel, especially the jet fuel, and the fact that we're getting larger and larger aircraft that take on more and more fuel when they're here drives those numbers up. So it's not really so much about freight in our case. It's about getting people in and out.
How do you let companies know that this is an amenity that not only they can use, but that they should use? How do you convince them that they don't have to fly their cargo into Indianapolis and then have it trucked north, for instance?
Well, we meet with all of our industry every year. We, you know, as I've said on the show before, I meet with their local management team. It's always a part of the discussion that I work in at some point. It's a part of our you know, our flyers, if you will, our information we give them. And then when I meet with their corporate leaders, you know, elsewhere, it's always something that I work into the discussion there just to make them aware. And then a lot of times it really is word of mouth within the flying community. As you know, these pilots all communicate and say, hey, you know, we flew to Crawfordsville and it was much easier to get in and out than it was, you know, a neighboring airport. What we've discovered is these pilots, they shop for fuel, much like you might have an app on your phone to buy gas for your car. And when we remain competitive in that market, will attract transient aircraft in just to get fuel, and we're seeing that happen. So it is about marketing, and I leave that up to the airport manager and the folks out there. They work in that world. They understand it, but I know they're constantly working as crews come in to make sure that, you know, they present a great image and that they provide over-the-top customer service, so that they'll also tell, you know, their associates that, hey, this is a great place to come.
Another quick topic in our last couple of minutes. The Montgomery County Community Foundation got a $500,000 grant, a matching grant recently from the Lilly Foundation for local initiatives. What's that money going to be used for?
Well, my understanding is, and again, it goes through the Community Foundation, so I'm not directly involved, but I think it can match on many different kinds of things. So I don't think there's one particular category earmarked. I think they're trying to match on several different projects, and you know, every indication I get from them is that you know, they'll feel they'll be very successful at maximizing this benefit, which is great for our community.
What does that mean? I mean, is there a specific initiative you want to see, or is there a specific type of grant you'd like them to pursue to get this extra money from Lilly, you know, aiming the money at a specific amenity or project?
No, I think what they're doing is they're taking, you know, people who are granting to existing needs, and they're using this to match and double their contribution, from what I understand. And I may have it wrong, but that's the way I understand it. So I don't think it's anything new. But if you were going to give, you know, $100 to whatever that you want to support, it now becomes $200.
I see. One last thing. We've talked on the show several times about the fact you hold a monthly open meeting where citizens can come and ask you pretty much whatever they want. And you're in a reelection year. You've done this a couple of times now. I wondered if the questions you get when your name is going to be on the ballot are different than the questions you get in non-election years.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's been a few years since we've been in an election, so I don't think so. I mean, in the questions I get in every day, you know, in the course of being out in the public every day, don't change during election year. And this is a very, very quiet election year in our community, at least at this point. It doesn't really change anything. It doesn't change the question again, and it definitely doesn't change how we conduct business. You know, we're going to do what we need to be doing, and we're going to continue to, you know, take all the information, and that means listening to the public as part of that. And you know, we do the community forums every month, whether it's an election year or not an election year, and I think that's important.
Does it have anything to do with the fact you're not challenged on the ballot again?
Well, I think that certainly can drive the conversation. You know, I mean, when there's, like I said, it's quiet and, you know, people aren't even thinking in terms of it being election year per se, the conversation is probably toned down quite a bit for sure.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time, and we'll look forward to doing it again next month.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Join us at the same time next week for our conversation with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can send emailed questions in advance if you'd like. ask@wbaa.org is our email address. Tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter. And find all of these shows archived on the Ask the Mayor page at wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.